A very warm welcome to the Change Conversations podcast, where we help individuals to reignite the spark, to look at their lives and careers with a different lens. Our interactions interrogate different individuals of all backgrounds who seek to be equipped for change in their careers and personal goals. I am your host, Mbume Ncube Daga, and I look forward to bringing you impactful change conversations. Hi, everybody. It's been a while, and I'm quite excited to be back with these conversations. And I'm very excited to have, I'm not going to say who I'm having today. They are going to introduce themselves. But I've been a fan of her career for a while, literally stalking her behind the scenes, and she had no clue that I was doing that. And I would like her to introduce herself, and then I'll introduce the topic that we are going to be tackling today. Hey, how are you?
Mpumi, thanks. I had no idea you were stalking me, as you say. So you were the person who ducked behind the pot plant at Woolworths.
I wish I was.
So Niven Postmer, a name which has been misheard on a memorable occasion as Kevin Costner. That's not who I am. And I am an author and a lecturer and a consultant in two key areas, in strategy and in power. And particularly the stuff around power is working with teams and groups and lecturing and hosting workshops on office politics.
Yeah, and that is the reason why we're here. So I had a conversation with you sometime last year because I did grab your book. So I bought your book when I saw it. And I thought, this is the one thing that I never got right in my corporate life. And you know the line, Niven, it says, I don't do office politics. I just don't do office politics. And your book says, office politics will do you in some shape, way, or form. So you need to acknowledge that it exists, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, that is, as you said perfectly, the title of the book. If you don't do politics, politics will do you. And Mpumi, I mean, my first executive position was when I was 29. I was so young. And then I had only senior leadership positions for my whole career. But I was exactly like you. This was not something someone ever taught me. And if they'd tried to, I would have run a mile because I also had my aversion to office politics as a badge of honor. I do not do that. I am just here to do my job. I don't play those stupid games. Do me a favor. And, you know, I had a very successful career, one that I'm very proud of. But every single time, if I think about the times when I hit my head against a brick wall, it was never about technical skill. It was always about the political stuff that was going on. And so you can have all the right answers technically. You can have all the right skills in terms of what's needed in a role. But if you don't have the political and relational skills, you're only going to go as so far. And it might not be as far as you need to or want to.
Yeah. So let's go back to the basics, because I look back and I remember myself saying that I don't do office politics a number of times. And as you say, nobody ever teaches this, never teaches us what office politics is about. So let's go back to the basic. A lecturer that you are, define for us what office politics is.
Yeah. So the best definition that I think is out there is the one that says it's the range of activities. So the range of ways that exist in organizations that are informal, that are unofficial, that are sometimes behind the scenes, and that exist to increase power, to sell ideas, to access information, to get things done. And so it's really, like I say, if it's in the informal, the unofficial, behind the scenes space, then it falls into the political realm. And what I always say to people is that, look, organizations have got two parts to them. Of course, there's the formal side, the visible side, you know, the delegations of authority, the organogram, all of the kinds of things that we see and that are real, the standard operating procedures, the policies. But there is an equally real side to organizations, and that's the informal side, the side that's not written down in any organogram or operating procedure or set of KPIs. And that's the space of the political and the relational. And you know, you can absolutely choose to, either through ignorance, like with you and me, or through determination, you can choose to ignore that informal side. I mean, it's your life, it's your career. But I always say, well, choosing to ignore the informal side, well, that's like playing soccer on half the field, tennis on half the court, because that informal side is as real as the formal, and it's as powerful. And in highly politicized organizations, in fact, that informal side is more powerful than the formal. And so you ignore it at your peril.
Yeah. So what does that informal side look like, though?
Well, I suppose that's where it depends on what kind of politics you're engaged in and what kind of political culture there is. People have said to me sometimes, yeah, you know, politics are a symptom of a bad culture. And I always correct that. And I say, no, bad politics are a symptom of a bad culture. But politics are a part of every culture. And so in minimally politicized environments, you know, really what you see is pretty much what you get. There's not that many conversations behind the scenes. There's no really strong ideas of in-groups and out-groups. And so that's in the minimally politicized part of the spectrum, but it goes all the way through to highly politicized organizations. And that often is a feature of complex organizations, matrixed organizations, or, I mean, almost always highly politicized. Large organizations, old organizations, organizations where people have been around for a long time, a lot of it is about in-groups and out-groups. And, you know, the other doesn't have to be on demographic lines, you know, race or gender. It can be like it was for me in one organization. The people who are on the outside are people who haven't been there for 30 years. The people who've been there and grown up in that place together, they're on the inside of what's going on. And so there is a spectrum of politics. And those are inevitable. They're normal. You're going to have to match your political appetite and skills with those cultures and with those types of political environments. What's sadly common but not normal is pathologically politicized organizations. So truly toxic political environments where everyone is out to get everyone else. People are watching their back all of the time. What you see is the complete opposite of what you get. In fact, people say one thing and do another. I mean, those things are truly, truly toxic. You know, they're going to kill you, literally or metaphorically. And so on my website, if anybody wants to download a workbook, there's a set of questions in my workbook around recognizing if you're in a politically toxic environment.
Yeah. And why is it, though, that we associate it more with the negative? Because there's a positive element to it where you get into relationships, you groom yourself, and you know where the power plays at. But the minute you say office politics, it equates to a negative, word.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I suppose there's a couple of reasons for it. I suppose it's the connotations of the word in the English language. Politics is not necessarily seen as something admirable or ethical. And interestingly, I had a woman connect with me on LinkedIn whose home language is Portuguese. And she said she could never understand why English colleagues were always complaining about politics, because there's no word for office politics in Portuguese. The closest that they have is relationships. And I mean, well, if it's about relationships, strategic relationships, well-placed relationships, I mean, that conjures up a very different connotation in all of our minds. And so I often say to people, listen, it doesn't matter what you call it, but essentially what you call it needs to be something that motivates you to want to do this and to do it well. And it's about four things. It's about power, it's about relationships, it's about reputation, and it's about influence. And so call it building your strategic relationships if you want to. Call it, I'm going to work to maximize my influence. Don't call it office politics, even though I've told you that the definition is neutral. But I think, you know, that's the reality with human beings. We see something complex and we make what Chimamanda Adichie talked about, a single story, a simple story. And so we've got this stereotype, which is not wrong. I mean, of course, there are bad politics, but it's totally incomplete. And so I think it also leads to the myth that I've spoken about, this myth of believing, well, I can either play office politics or I can be a good person. Yes, absolutely. If your definition is that it's only about being a psychopath, well, then it is an either or choice. But if you understand, as you've said, the range of ways that you can do this and engage in it and be more effective, not just for yourself, but for your team, for your stakeholders. Well, then that's not an either or choice. It's a both and imperative.
Yeah. And I think back, because there's always just that panic that comes with the word. And I find that, as I said, most of us have, it has impacted our career growth, because you haven't been able to see how are you supposed to do this? What does it mean? Because there's that connotation, as you say, of equating politics to bad politics. And we know that that's not the case. So how can you do it ethically and authentically? What does that look like?
So it's all, I suppose, contextual and personal and subjective, right? So what drives you, the values that matter to you, I think inform hopefully a lot of what you do. And for me, for example, I always thought, look, I can't play politics because one of my key values is integrity. And it would seem to me that this whole thing is the complete opposite of integrity. And actually, I think the very first thing that you can do is to change your mindset. Actually undergo a bit of a paradigm shift here, saying, hold on, if I'm going to be effective, if I'm going to play on that whole soccer field, that whole tennis court, how do I want to do that? What is the way that I think makes sense to me? But I want to do it because I need to do it, not just for myself and everyone else. Because, you know, developing the political will is going to be impossible if you've got this either or psychopath or decent person, play politics or not. So you've got to develop the political will, and that requires a mindset shift. And then the political skill, I mean, it's always, always about relationships. It's about stakeholders. It's about understanding what other people need and want and looking to understand where you can meet their needs. And so I always say to people, listen, three things. First of all, please don't make the mistake of saying or thinking that your work will speak for itself. Okay? Because people, work does not speak. Human beings speak. And so thinking that your work will speak for itself because you're working really hard and somebody's going to notice and give you an A, well, that's like treating work like school, and work is not school. People need to speak on your behalf. Mm-hmm. Second thing is to understand that some of the most important decisions of your career, and possibly even all of the most important decisions of your career, are going to be made when you are not in the room. Who is in that room for you and what are they saying? That is not about formal authority. That's about informal influence and relationships and sponsors and people who have got your back and want to see you succeed, or equally possible, people who want to not see you succeed. And so the third thing is to understand that you don't go to school, don't go to work to make friends. I'm not one of those people who is using that as a shorthand of, I'm not here to make friends. I'm just going to be as obnoxious and dictatorial as I want. I mean, look, no, thanks. But what I'm saying is, when we go to work to get things done. And to get things done, you need allies. You need coalitions of support. You need people who will back you. And you need to minimize your adversaries, the people who will block you. If you make friends, well, I mean, isn't that one of the joys of life? And I've made some incredibly good friends at work who enrich my life in all kinds of ways long after I've left the organization. But that wasn't the point. The point was to get things done. And you need to do that by having the right people on your side. And so again, in the workbook, which is freely available, people can download it, there's a whole bunch of ways to assess yourself. Who is in your network? How wide and diverse is your network in terms of people who can speak for you, people who can give you opportunities, people who can give you information? If it's a network that's very narrow, that looks and sounds just like you in terms of demographics, in terms of seniority, in terms of expertise, in terms of background, in terms of company, well, that's not necessarily good or bad, because I never make a value judgment around this, but it's not as useful as a network that's wide and diverse and giving you much more opportunities and information. How much power do you think you have? And can you audit that? And how much power do you have relative to somebody else? How much leverage do you have? How are you going to craft a political strategy? What do you want to achieve? Now, who do you need in your side to make that happen. And so there are so many ways that, given the context that you're in, because every context is different, given what you're trying to achieve, given the lines that you will and won't draw in terms of what you will and won't do. Okay, so what are the range of options open here to me to build the relationships that I need, to understand where I'm getting support and to hold on to it, to understand where I'm getting blockages and try to understand why and work around it or get people on my side. I mean, there are tons of things that you can do. And like I said, it's useful to work through my workbook because the last question is, okay, now what's your political strategy? Where are you going to go from here?
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like a task, a big thing. Like you need to be intentional and conscious about it.
Yes.
And yeah.
No, you absolutely do. Look, I mean, I remember a delegate in one workshop a few years ago saying to me, once we'd gone through, you know, I start the lectures talking about the political will that you need and why you need to get involved in this and why you need to understand it. But political will is only so useful. I mean, then you need some political skill. So what are some of those things? And so I'd gone through a lot of this. And this one delegate looked at me and she said, oh, never. This sounds like a lot of work. And I said to her, yes, well, it is. But particularly the more senior you get, the more you will understand that, in fact, it's not a distraction from your job. It is your job. Because it's the people below you who are doing the technical work. Your role is to navigate the landscape, to get the support that you need for them to be able to do their job, to lobby for the interests that you think are important, to get the budget, the support, the resources. That's your job. And you are only going to be able to do that through the relationships that you've built up. And so it is absolutely about being intentional. And like I say, again, that comes to a mindset shift, understanding this is not something you get to when you've gotten through your inbox, i.e. never. This is as much a part of your job as your inbox. In fact, it's probably more important because having the right people in your corner is going to make a whole bunch of things a whole bunch easier.
Yeah. But having the right people in your corner doesn't entail to ass cripping and all those things that come with it.
Yeah. You know, people often are concerned. They're thinking, oh, it's this bootlicking. It's this ingratiating. It's this false smiles and agreeing. Yeah. I don't have the aptitude or the stomach, quite frankly, for that. And so I think there's two things that people need to understand. One is you don't necessarily have to like the people you need, but if you need them, you need to have them on your side. Now, let's be really clear, especially in the context of South Africa, where we've had some disasters in terms of governance and ethics and all kinds of things. I am not talking about turning a blind eye to things that are illegal and frankly criminal. And we have no shortage of that. And that's outside of the field of play of what I'm talking about here. But inside of the field of play, when you go to work, as I said, you go to get things done. Now, who do you need on your side to get things done? And how do you build up a relationship? It doesn't have to be a best friend relationship. It doesn't have to be liking everything about them relationship. It can be a purely transactional relationship, but you need them. So how are you going to get them on your side? Because, you know, you go to work to be effective and you need other people to be effective. And I think often people are also concerned about authenticity. Oh, this doesn't feel authentic. Well, let's just think about that. Look, if all your relationships are transactional, if all your relationships are only about benefiting you, then I think you've got a problem.
Yeah.
But sometimes some relationships are purely transactional.
Hopefully you want to get things done, right?
Exactly. Hopefully in your whole network of relationships, they are more than just transactional. Hopefully in that whole world of relationships, you are giving as much as you are taking. But this idea of authenticity, I personally think is overrated because Jeffrey Pfeffer, who writes brilliantly on power, he's a professor at Stanford Graduate School of Business. He says, actually, as a leader, the authenticity that you need is being authentic to what the situation requires. What does the situation require of me? And I mean, I can see that having been the CEO of two organizations and in very senior positions. Sometimes the situation required of me to project hope and confidence that I didn't necessarily feel.
Yeah.
But my team did not need to know what I was really feeling. They needed to feel that everything was going to be okay. And they needed to hear that from me. If I'd been authentic, I would have been in a soggy heap crying, saying, I don't know what we're going to do here. And so I needed to transcend my own fears and give them the hope and confidence that they needed. That's what the situation required. And then, you know, similarly, sometimes the situation required that I actually show my humanity and my common concern, and that we had a very, very real conversation around how scared we all were or how worried we all were. So these things always, again, are contextual, but it's not about letting everything hang out. It's about how do I need to show up in this situation to be effective for the people that are counting on me? And if that sometimes means swallowing your dislike of somebody, well, you swallow that dislike and you get on with it.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That gives a different perspective. Because as you say, the word authentic gets thrown around a lot, right?
Yes. Yes.
And it's got different connotations and definitions to different people. And what you've just explained, I think, gives a different perspective. So whilst going through your book, and within this office politics conversation, there's a lot of power and influence conversations that are happening. So what does that mean? And as a person who's maybe listening to us thinking, what the heck are they going on about? Why is this a big deal?
So there's a lovely matrix in the book, which has on its one axis power. So a high level position or a low level position. And then on the other one, a high degree of influence or a low degree of influence. And if you have got low power and low influence, from this model's perspective, and let's be clear, all models are wrong because they can't possibly take the complexity of life and reduce it to four quadrants.
Yeah.
But some are just useful. And I think this model is a very useful one. So if you have low formal power, so you're pretty low in the hierarchy and low influence, then you're a weakling from a power point of view. Okay. If you have high formal power, so you've got a relatively high position, but you've got no influence, then you are what this model calls an empty suit. Moving to higher influence, but low position, the classic example here is personal assistants. I mean, PAs can be invisible in an organogram, but heavens, they can have a lot of influence because they're gatekeepers.
Yeah.
And then the last one is high level positions, so high power and formal authority and high influence. Well, then you're in a sweet spot of a political winner. And so there's two reasons that I think this model is important. The one is in looking through your stakeholders and looking through the people you need to get on your side. I'm not in any way saying that their value as human beings is not important. But if you've got finite time, which we all do, you need to spend that finite time not on weaklings and empty suits. You can build relationships with them if you like them. But in terms of getting things done and needing to have somebody who has your back and can actually speak for you, weaklings and empty suits are not going to be able to do that. You need persuaders and power players. So that's the one thing. Okay, who fits into this matrix and who do I need on my side? So it helps you differentiate. And then the second thing is it helps you understand, where am I? And you might not ever get to a very senior position or the ultimate position. You might not want to. Totally understand that. And formal authority and formal positions and formal power, that's limited. I mean, there's only so many places in an organization. There's only so many opportunities to get more senior. But informal influence, that's infinite. And anyone can have that. And so you're thinking about this and saying, how do I navigate this? How do I build this? How do I understand this relative to other people so that I'm being as effective as I possibly can in where I'm spending my time with other people and how I'm positioning myself? I mean, this can help make something that can feel overwhelming and very complex and opaque a lot more clear. Because, don't spend my time there. Don't spend my time there. Maximize my time there. Because it's going to have the most investment return in terms of time and energy.
Yeah. I think just thinking through that, it's literally looking at your stakeholders and plotting them on this day.
Exactly.
And, yeah. Because I always say people just didn't wake up and become CEOs. They were very intentional about getting to the level. And they had a plan and a strategy that they crafted to be able to get there.
Yes. And of course, being CEO is not the only or ultimate definition of success. There can be multiple ones that are very different for you. But the point is, for you to be successful, however you define it, it's going to take other people's support. And one of the most impressive women people I've ever met was in the top six exco of a very large organization, 60,000 people across the world. And she was in her early 40s. So she was fairly young when she got the position. Mm-hmm. And we were chatting the one day and she just happened to mention, and it was like a light bulb went on over my head. She just happened to mention that from the start of her career, so 20 odd years, every month, from when she was still quite junior, she sat down and she had a stakeholder map for the month ahead. Who do I need to sit and have coffee with? Who do I need to send a presentation to? Who do I need to have a phone call with and ask for their help? Who do I need to update? You know, whatever. She had a whole bunch of metrics. And then for the rest of the month, she delivered against that stakeholder map. And then she started the next month. And she'd basically been doing this for over 20 years. And, you know, all of a sudden I thought, okay, so you're very technically smart. You're very highly respected. But all of a sudden your success, which is quite phenomenal, makes even more sense. Because that degree of deliberate, focused intentionality around something that was a practice rather than something she got to when she had time. I'm like, okay, this makes a whole bunch more sense.
No, it does. And it's something that I literally learned in, what, the last 5 years of my career or last 6 years of my career. And I think back, like I was at Unilever and I was mentored by the group CFO of Unilever, which was big back in the
day. That's huge, yes.
Exactly. But there was, I think, the gap. Now I reflect back and I say, because he was very instrumental in my career, but I didn't maintain, I didn't see who I were, the other stakeholders that I could pull in my corner, all those things where I didn't know. You don't know what you don't know, right?
Yeah.
And now I look back and I think, you know what? You could have been you could have been much bigger than what you are, but it is what it is. And you've succeeded in whichever way you think you have, which I think is great.
Yes.
But my other question to you is, what mistakes have you witnessed people, mainly the people that say they don't do office politics, what mistakes have you witnessed?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, there are so many ways that you can commit political suicide. And it reminds me of two quotes. The first is one by Winston Churchill, where he said, look, in war, you can only be killed once, but in politics, you can be killed many times.
Right.
And then the second one is from Einstein, where he apparently said, when he was asked, what's the difference between genius and stupidity? He said, genius has its limits. So I thought that was fabulous. And, you know, when it comes to being stupid politically, there's no limits to some of the things that I've heard. So if I had to maybe narrow it down to just a few, the first one, I think, is to publicly criticize your company. I mean, I saw this happen the other day and I just thought, you've got to be kidding me. This woman, senior manager, was sitting in customer in training and in a workshop around customer service, goes onto Facebook and says, well, why on earth I'm having to do this? I don't know, because everybody knows that this company, XXX, doesn't care about their customers. I sat there and I thought, yeah, exactly. I mean, I thought, you know, Facebook didn't make you stupid. Facebook has now given you a platform in an era where Google never forgets to have that stupidity out there forever. And surprise, surprise, she was out of a job in a week. So publicly criticizing your company, publicly criticizing your boss, alienating your boss, very bad moves. And particularly when it comes to your boss, I always say, listen, if you don't trust your boss, you need to find another boss. But if you are not trusted by your boss, well, then you're probably going to have to find another job. And there are three parts to trust, right? The first is competence. Fine. So you need to know your job and know what you're doing. But that's the rational side. That's the KPI formal side. The other two elements of trust are competent, are character and caring. If your boss doesn't feel that you care enough about what you're doing and care enough about them and want to make them look good, and if they don't trust your character, you're going to have a very, very bad time, because a boss has a lot of control over your life. So you're not indebted to your boss. None of us are slaves. We have agency. We can choose alternative environments and alternative bosses. But you need to be trusted by your boss if you're going to make as much of an impact as you want. And then I think the third one is becoming the problem. So I'm seeing that with somebody at the moment. And I've said to her, you need to be really careful here. She's very senior, been in a company for, I think, 20 odd years, and things have changed. A new CEO, a new strategy, a new approach. And she will not stop complaining and moaning about the change. And she has some leverage and she has some political capital, but it's getting less and less every day because she's making this all about herself. And if she doesn't like the strategy, she must go. But if she is there and thinking that this degree of complaining is going to get her anything other than an exit pass, she's wrong. So I've said to her, look, I think you need to speak to two people. I think you need to speak to a coach, and I think you need to speak to a labor lawyer. Because if this is so unpalatable to you, then you need to be negotiating an exit here. Because if you don't negotiate one, then they're going to negotiate you out of there. And suddenly you're going to be in a position that you don't want to be. And I think you need to be speaking about a coach, about how you show up differently, or about who you're going to be next and what you want to do next. So becoming the problem with capital letters, very bad move. Because as I say in my book, quoting another book, you know, there's only so many last chances that a manager will give with somebody who's taking up a disproportionate amount of their time and energy and attention. There's only so many chances that you'll give before they start to fantasize about how much easier life would be if you were gone. And then surprise, surprise, you will be gone.
Wow. Yeah, that's hectic, right? You speak about political capital.
Yes.
Just expand a little bit more there.
Yeah. So as with any capital or currency, you know, it's about the amount of power you have, the kind of relationships you have, the kind of reputation that you have, and the kind of influence that you have. And the more you have of these, and they're multidirectional, and they are all mutually reinforcing. And so it's very difficult to figure out the causal order. You know, does your good reputation give you the power, which then gets you the influence, which then gets you the relationships? Or does it start with relationships? It really doesn't matter. The point is, these things reinforce each other for better or for worse. So the stronger and more strategic your relationships, and therefore your power, and therefore your reputation, and therefore your influence, the more political capital you have, the more leverage you have to draw on. The less of all of these things that you have, so too the less your political capital.
Yeah. Wow. It is. It's one of those, as we're saying, that it's one of those things that you really need to be intentional. And if you don't do it and you think you'll survive corporate, I can tell you it really doesn't work out that well.
Yeah, so two things. I think you may survive, but you won't thrive. No. And whether you survive is an open question. And I think the second thing is, it's not just corporate. It's every organization, right? I've worked in the public sector. I've worked in NGOs. I've worked in corporates. I've worked in South Africa. I've worked overseas. This is a feature of how human beings work when we are in a shared environment, in a shared organization. So corporate politics have got a bad rap, but like a friend of mine who was a church minister for 10 years said, when she moved to corporate, she was so petrified about corporate politics. And I asked her after a few months, how's it going? No, I'm loving it. I mean, moving from being a church minister to whatever role she had, I can't remember now, I really enjoyed the change. And I said to her, yeah, but the corporate politics, how's that going? Because you were really scared about that. She said, oh, Niven, corporate politics. Do me a favor. They've got nothing on church politics, okay? So you will find this wherever you go.
It is, because I don't know if it's you who quotes the family politics, because I've read that. Yes. You're also, even in families, there's family politics in some shape, way, or form. Yes. And you decide that auntie, I don't know, auntie, my space. So you already have stakeholder matrices of who's in your corner, who's not in your corner.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, if my dad was in a bad mood, we'd get my younger sister to go speak to him because he just couldn't say no to her. Oh, yeah, we do this stuff all the time.
And the minute it's in a work environment, it's like it's evil. And everybody thinks, like, what is this all about? But this is what we live through every day.
Exactly. Perfectly put.
Anyway, this was an interesting conversation. So tell me, what is the one thing that you would like somebody to take out of this conversation?
I suppose it's the title of the book. You know, if you don't do this, it will do you. And you can do this ethically and decently. And hopefully you will, because as I've said before, but I really want to emphasize, it's not just about you. It is about the people who are counting on you to be effective. And the more senior you get, the more effectiveness becomes around the relational and the political, not the technical. So for your sake and for others, this stuff matters.
Yeah. And I'm backtracking, but this just popped in my head. If you were still in a junior position, how does this play out? Because the junior position has got a lot to do with the technical delivery in a work environment. So how does it play out in that space?
Yeah, absolutely it does. And remember the story I spoke about a woman from her first position, relatively junior, she was still working with her stakeholders. And so I think it's about not thinking that this only comes at a certain level, that then you have to get political. Knowing that your stakeholder management, your impression management, cultivating the right relationships, having people know what you're doing, because your work's not speaking for itself, you're speaking for it, which then also requires that you know the impact and value of your work and that you can own it and you can claim it. That starts right from the beginning of your career. And so I think one of the biggest things that I've seen youngsters make is to think, okay, well, when I get to this level, then I'll have to start doing it. No, you'll have to start doing it to a different level and at in a different way and to a different degree, perhaps. But you can and should start being intentional about this stuff right from the word go. And not making the classic mistake of treating work like school, because it's not. You have to own your stuff, and you have to make sure that other people know about it.
Yeah. But you talk about other people knowing your work. And I remember working in an environment where there was just somebody who ended up being a pain in one for people to know their work. Like, where do you draw the line? There's letting people know the work, but there's like overbearingness, if there's a word like that, that comes with it. And you're WhatsApping people about the things you're doing, and this manager needs to know, and that manager needs to know. And it just feels like, can you just stop?
Yeah.
Like, so look, where do you draw the line?
That's for you to decide. Okay. But people often, it's interesting, because they've seen examples of one or two people being obnoxious and overbearing. And that's an extreme that none of us want, you know, the kind of person whose ego walks in the door 2 minutes before they do. Of course, that's an extreme. Of course, it's unpalatable. But then we go to the other extreme and say, well, we won't do any of this because we've seen that. But at the other extreme is invisible contributions have no value. And so how do you for yourself understand where and how are you going to make these contributions known? Again, to repeat, it requires that you actually understand and can claim your contributions. And I think often for women, this is very difficult. No, it's about the team. It's about everyone else.
Yeah.
And what have you done? And what has the role been? Can you even articulate it for yourself? And if you can't, well, nobody else can either. So that's often a challenge. But then how you let the right people know in the right way, well, that's contextual and that's up to you. But I suppose it's also always about, it's not about activity. It's not about exhausting people with a laundry list of the 70 things you did before month end. It's about outcome. It's not about output. It's about outcome. It's about impact. These are the things that I did that made a huge difference. And this is why I'm claiming them and you need to know about them. And being selective and strategic about dropping that message to the right people is very different to anybody who will listen and even a few people who won't. Just telling them how busy you are and how many things that you've done. Nobody cares. Nobody cares, okay? But they do care about the impact. And they do want to understand that if you can articulate it and own it. But yeah, a laundry list of ego, kind of ego stroking behaviors. People are going to be ducking behind the pot plants the way that I was with you in Woolworths.
It could be painful having to listen.
it's painful. It's obnoxious. It's pointless. It's self-aggrandizing. And sometimes it pays off. But you have to have a pretty thick skin to go that route. And unless you have a very thick skin and you're quite happy to just sing your own praises all day, every day, you're probably not going to follow that route. And while it sometimes pays off, generally it alienates people.
Yeah, people see through it. People see through it. I think that's the most important part. And it, yeah, I know. And I can visualize this person doing it as I'm speaking to you.
Sure. I can visualize a few of them myself.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for taking the time. I really, really appreciate this. And I love your book. And I think it's the one thing that I keep. I've got a few people that I've been mentoring. And it's the one thing I keep saying to them, just don't go around saying you don't do office politics. Take the time to understand what it's all about and find ways and means that work for you, that you're quite comfortable, that it's ethical, it feels comfortable for you. And at the core of it all, it's all about building those relationships and making sure that the right people know what you're doing, because that's what matters for your career growth.
Absolutely. And, you know, I always say to people in Pune, look, if you still, after a podcast like this or after reading my book, choose not to engage in politics, that's your choice. But then hopefully it's an informed choice. You know what you're doing, why you're doing it, and you don't have this blanket story that's completely incomplete around what you're not doing. So make an informed choice, understand the risks, understand the potential trade-offs, and then do whatever you want with your career. But don't come at it with a single story that's wrong.
Yeah. So where do people find you on social media these days?
Yeah. So I'm very active on LinkedIn. I generally post at least once a day. And it's been so lovely, you know, to have conversations with people all over the world that I'll never meet and to get comments from people all over the world about the book and how much it's helped them. So LinkedIn is the best place to connect. It's really the only place.
Okay. Thank you. That's where I found you. And you, I told you the story that when I saw a message, a DM into my inbox, I was like, oh, she connected with me. And I was telling everybody how excited I was.
That's fabulous.
And that's the third part, though. It gets me to a point where we are so fearful to reach out to people, right? And you get pulled back and you think, oh, they might reject me. They might not answer me. And what I've learned in my old age is, why not? Just take the chance, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I wrote an article about it the other day that when we think about risk again, we only think about the one kind of risk, the risk that bad things will not happen. And of course, that's right. But there's another kind of risk, technically speaking, and that's the risk that good things will not happen.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, connect. I mean, especially in this day and age, what a great opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you for your time. I really, really highly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
So for anybody that was hearing us, please follow our podcast and our YouTube channel. Share, comment. I would really love to get your feedback around this conversation on office politics. It's something that is dear to my heart and where I would love the younger people that are growing up to and getting into corporate. It must be the first thing that they kind of keep at the back of their heads. As you said, that lady who started it from when she started, being a CEO at 40 or being in the board at 40 or whatever success looks like for you, I think that's the most important thing that anybody can do. Thanks, Divine. I really highly appreciate.
It's a pleasure for me.
Thank you for listening to Change Conversations. If you enjoyed our show and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and kindly post about it on your social media platforms. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram and YouTube.
at Change Conversations with Mpume. I am Mpume Ncube-Daka signing out, and I will see you again next week.